Chapter 10. Into the Land. Murmuring rouses him. The sun has sunk, leaving only flint-dark shreds of cloud. Now twilight is all around, fireglow quickly fading into the steppe. Blinking and stretching on the elder mother's lap, he sits up. Hers and the others' faces are turned to the western horizon, lit by a still luminous quartz sky above the shelter. This year, by the river where the great churned muds usually were, the deer had not crossed. So they'd waited for many days until some hunters left to search farther upstream. Stomachs are long past groans, gone into empty holes. Then he hears it. Ooh! The hunt returning, singing of the meat and the fat. Remembering its melting taste and the crisp of charred antler skin, saliva springs almost painfully in his mouth. Scrambling up, he's surrounded by moving legs, carried on the swell of anticipation as the people make ready. The elder mother calls out. Older children run brave into the dark to meet the hunters. He lingers close to the light of the hearth. Fanged ones always follow kills. But his feet dance as the unmade deer arrive on many shoulders, haloed by puffed breath in the frigid air. No matter the cold, tonight all will sleep warmed by blood. For all the spectacular, intimate details we have about individual sites, Neanderthals were fundamentally nomadic. Their world was the land, and moving in it was life. Like everything else they did, this was far from random. Sites were not simply destinations, but intersections, nodes within networks stretching hundreds of kilometres. The blood-stained, fur-tufted muds at a kill site, an ephemeral locale, were nevertheless linked to caves or rock shelters through the animal bodies taken there to be further divided. All places Neanderthals went were connected by their physical movements and the things they carried. Each new kindled fire was a glowing pearl in an unbroken string laced across ridges and threaded through forests. To begin understanding how interconnectedness was at the heart of things, we must rise upwards like smoke from the hearths. Central points to their home spaces, they were nonetheless linked to the wider world through their constituent materials. Comparing fuels to reconstructed ecologies, it's possible to work out where firewood was foraged from at a local landscape scale. For the El Salt fires that burned around 55,000 years ago, all wood species were coming from within 2 to 3 hours' walk. In this way, tiny smears of charcoal transport us outwards, to Neanderthals striding through pine scrub and climbing ridges out of sight of home. Mapping the great entanglements farther out between other things and places is extraordinarily complicated. But doing so opens up truly enlightening vistas into their lives. How we move. Most living descendants of Neanderthals have forgotten what it is to truly move, shifting from place to place seasonally, never mind doing so on foot. Water and stone were to some extent reliable and static resources, but plants and animals were more mutable and survival depended on their availability. Among recent hunter-gatherers, settling in one place for a long time, or only moving across small areas, is rare, because outside the tropics, environments are mostly not rich enough. In higher latitudes, low mobility only becomes possible in particular circumstances with predictable, high-quality foods that are either abundant year-round or can be stored. The archaeological record shows that, wherever they lived, Neanderthals were focused on hunting large beasts, even if they also took small game, seafood, and plants when possible. This means that whether they stalked cool steppe tundra or warm forests, moving multiple times each year was still necessary. But the diversity of the environments means we should expect the frequency and distance to vary. Based on what we see in recent hunter-gatherers, open, colder settings require people to be highly mobile and move methodically over huge ranges. And even if deciduous forests generally don't usually involve very long distance movement, it's not easy to stay in any place for long, as finding large animals is harder and other resources quickly become used up. But it's not just about food. Mobility is a never-ending waltz danced between subsistence and technology. Finding stone and choices in how it was napped imposed their own demands that motivated movement. Actually mapping out how this happened is fiendishly complicated, however. Even with the resolution in dating available today, it's almost impossible to be sure that any two sites within a given region were in use at the same time by one Neanderthal group. There's no equivalent to the microscale methods for determining if halves within a single layer really were contemporary with each other. Instead, archaeologists must shift perspective and consider different kinds of questions. Based on how repeated choices by individuals and groups coalesced into long-term patterns shared across many sites. But before delving into the detail, it's important to understand why measuring Neanderthal mobility matters. Just as much as technology, it gives a view into how their minds worked, and has fueled debates about their cognitive capacity and sophistication. If Neanderthals planned activities ahead of time and had a schedule of sorts for where to move, this implies that they could imagine the future and had enough brain power to maintain goals over days, weeks, or even months. Therefore, the complexity of mobility systems is important, but the extent of travel is another key factor. If groups were moving farther, not only was the planning element more impressive, but it also points to larger range sizes. As we'll explore below, territory size has implications for how connected Neanderthal societies were. It's been obvious for decades that Neanderthals routinely separated activities between different points in the landscape. They didn't set up a new camp each time they reached a rock source or opened up a steaming carcass. Initial napping locales, where stone was found, tested, and prepared, and animal kill sites are identifiable precisely because they lack the later stage lytic products and the richest parts of hunted animals. Looking first at how butchery was fragmented through the landscape, this pattern is obvious at places like Schöningen and continues over hundreds of thousands of years. In southeast France, a rocky bluff at Cancieux around 55,000 years ago preserves a record of systematic butchery. For big game, the least fatty or meaty parts are all that remains. Horse hips and still articulated backbones, heavy woolly rhino jaws, mammoth teeth. For smaller species, heads and whole joints are also missing. Where did the good stuff go? In many places we can make out an intermediate type of site, essentially hunting camps, where Neanderthals further processed either partial carcasses or selected joints. Some hunting camps, like Les Pradelles, were used over and over, hinting that they were connected to particular kill sites Neanderthals returned to many times, like Schöningen and Cancieux. The final destination for food, either directly from kill sites or coming via hunting camps, was to what we can think of as central locations, or more prosaically, homes. This includes big sites like Abric-Romani, where masses of third stage processing happened, involving a lot of bone smashing and some cooking, plus presumably eating and sleeping. The richness of the archaeology, combined with concurrent use of different parts of the site, following quite specific patterns of activity, is very good evidence that Neanderthals were spending more than a day at a time there. Did Neanderthals have concepts of place that would match our category of kill site versus central place? Clearly, they lived according to traditional ways of doing things, the repetition of which created the spatial patterning we can see both within sites and between locales across the landscape. But beyond this, did they really schedule their lives beyond the next meal? Hunter-gatherers the world over are extremely attuned to seasonal changes in resources, such as the arrival of herds, and plan to arrive at particular places at the right time. Did Neanderthals have winter and summer camps, or was their existence more itinerant, living as hobo hominins? Working this out involves thinking about how things interconnected. As the last chapter showed, even where we have high-definition archaeology, there's no evidence anywhere for truly long-term settlement on the order of many months. Some places like Abrikramani were used more often, certainly for several days, or perhaps longer, and probably by bigger groups. Even large open-air sites like La Folie, with clear activity zones, obviously weren't lived in for months. And at the other end of the spectrum are locales such as Abric del Pastor, visited very briefly and by no more than a handful of individuals at a time. It's these short-stay sites that contain hints of seasonal patterns. Another example is Level 3 at Teixeira's Cave, northeast Spain. Between around 51 and 40,000 years ago, there are multiple phases when Neanderthals briefly stayed, interspersed with evidence of carnivores moving in. Most interesting, the hunted species showed different seasonal patterns. The time of year deer were killed changes through different sublevels, but horses were always dying in late spring through to early summer. This pattern is strikingly similar to that at Abrikramani, which is around 150 kilometres or 90 miles southwest. It seems that in this region of northeast Iberia, Neanderthals moved regularly and hunted deer that were available all year round. But horses were only killed over very short periods. The time of year isn't clear at Abrikramani, but at Teixeira's it was possible to fine-tune down to season thanks to a bird assemblage accumulated by predators. Chaff and magpie remains showed a distinctive bone condition that develops before they lay eggs, which cannot have happened prior to mid-spring. Moreover, their carcasses would only have been brought in by carnivores if there weren't any hominins about yet. Put together, the horse hunting was very likely late spring, early summer, which is precisely when horses come together for breeding and can be distracted and vulnerable. What's also interesting about Teixeira's is that it has far fewer lithics and hearths than Abrikramani, but more faunal remains, including a higher proportion of horse. Though they mostly arrived already jointed, the animal remains in general look slightly less intensively smashed up than at Abrikramani. And in another contrast between the sites, a bit of rabbit hunting was also going on at Teixeira's. Quite clearly, Teixeira's was a different kind of place, with probably smaller groups staying for briefer periods. It might even have sometimes been more like a hunting camp than a place where meat, marrow and fat were ending up. Yet neither is it like the far more ephemerally visited Abric del Pastor and El Salt, which truly look like places very small parties of Neanderthals stopped at for a couple of nights at most. Level 4 at Abric del Pastor is striking, since Neanderthals were apparently mostly interested in hunting and butchering tortoises, with a smattering of ibex that was probably also taken locally. But alongside those species were rare deer, horse and aurochs bones, mainly bits of leg and the odd head. It's possible that, just as Neanderthals carried lithics around as a kind of travel toolkit, they also took other resources. Those random bones could be remnants of provisions from elsewhere. In a larger assemblage, this kind of subtle signal would become invisible. And the lithics match this. All the RMUs at Abric del Pastor tend to look very fragmented. Neanderthals were dumping old tools and taking just a few flakes off cores that they then carried onwards, presumably along with some of the tortoise meat. These Iberian sites stand for others across the whole Neanderthal world. Some were short stopping places, others homes for longer periods, but all were points on a cycle of movement. For Neanderthals living by a never-ending odyssey, Ithaca was the journey, not the destination. For sites where the length of occupation phases is measurable, it's something up to a few centuries. Successive generations grew up in these caves and rock shelters, following the same routines and traditions, which became physically part of the site itself through hearths, waste dumps, and well-trodden floors. But then things changed, and nobody visited, sometimes for 1,000 years or more. Either groups relocated to entirely different areas, or the population itself petered out. It's noticeable that the least homely site, Abric del Pastor, appears to have lain empty for the longest spans of time, which might mean that populations moving into the region were unfamiliar with all its nooks and crannies. Shifting stone. Individual sites, even comparing across regions, only give us a keyhole view into what Neanderthals did across the landscape. To understand their true scales of mobility, archaeologists need to map individual movements. The most obvious way to do this is by tracking their most abundant resource, stone. Finding out where the lithics in any assemblage originally came from illuminates, at least partly, their actual journeys between sources and sites. Things are never simple, however, and as prehistorians have learned over the decades, geology is tricky. What's casually referred to as flint includes silica-based rocks formed by varied processes during many ancient eons. It takes extraordinary effort and time to map thousands of flint sources and examine and classify them based on structure, microfossils, and chemical profiles. On top of that are different taphonomic permutations causing rock to change on its journey before a Neanderthal even picked it up. Stone from the same primary outcrop looks quite different once it's tumbled down from a ridge, rolled along a river, and eroded out of gravels, all secondary sources. By creating gigantic stone libraries, mapping flint and other kinds of rock sources, it's possible to directly compare them with lithic artefacts. This reveals exactly where Neanderthals had been prior to bringing these objects into a particular site. The results show that, just as with animal bodies, they followed broad rules in transporting stone, based on assessing quality and distance. There's usually a lot of the closest available stone types from within about 5 to 10 kilometres or 3 to 6 miles, even if the quality wasn't great. This would be collected while doing other things like hunting within a couple of hours wandering of the site. And while they'd use it, bad rock was never carried into areas with good stuff. Stone from farther away is almost always present too, and this is what excites archaeologists, because it directly connects individual places to points in much larger landscapes. The more distant the rock type, the fewer artefacts made from it there will be. Typically, less than 10% will come from far-flung sources over 60 kilometres or 40 miles away. The very longest distances, more than 300 kilometres or 190 miles, are found for the purest silica rock of all, obsidian. But even decent flint was sometimes carried over 100 kilometres or 60 miles. Interpreting what this means in terms of movement is, however, fraught with difficulty. Considering each assemblage in isolation, You might assume that Neanderthals were making special trips to get decent stone. But since other evidence shows they mostly stayed for relatively short periods at any site, that wouldn't make sense in energetic terms. Instead, what's much more probable is that far-travelled objects were simply the survivors from a selection of tools Neanderthals travelled with during their perambulations between Stone Source and other sites. Backing this up is the fact that high-quality stone is hardly ever transported directly in raw state to Knapp. Instead, as we saw in Chapter 6, in virtually all cases, artifacts that came from furthest away are products like Levallois flakes, bifaces, and tools, often obviously resharpened. Similarly, rare cores from distant sources had already seen a lot of Knapping before being abandoned. Remarkably, in high-definition sites like Abric del Pastor, it's possible to actually pick out travel gear. In single half phases with tiny lithic assemblages, the few artifacts made from distant stone must be things one of the handful of Neanderthals who had stayed there decided to leave behind. While it's impossible to trace the journey of an individual stone block, it's clear that Neanderthals weren't moving as the crow flies between distant stone source and site. Individual flakes of high-quality distant rock are sometimes the only things left behind, having been removed off bifaces or tools that were then carried on further. In some cases, even cores were carried a considerable way, over 40 kilometres or 25 miles, before being knapped, then removed again. We don't know how many places such objects visited before dropping out of circulation, but the discovery of second-generation products made from rocks sourced 100 kilometres or 60 miles away suggests that three or more locales might not have been unusual. It's been suggested that because Neanderthals didn't routinely transport high-quality stone in bulk, they weren't well organised. Aside from the fact that they did occasionally do this, what's clear is that it mostly just wasn't necessary. In later periods where we see Homo sapiens doing this, it's largely because they were so focused on blades, a technology that can be far less adaptable to average or poor stone. Overall, what we see in Neanderthals matches how recent hunter-gatherers organised their use of stone in the landscape. Personal travel gear is selected based on multiple factors: the expected activities, the amount of travelling, and, crucially, what kind of stone would be available en route. This last point is key because it is yet more evidence of Neanderthals possessing detailed knowledge of geological resources and thinking ahead. They knew the places with bad rock that were worth bringing good cores to, and conversely, those with nearby decent stone with which to restock. And as always, Neanderthals weren't robots. They adapted their approach depending on the geological situation. If necessary, middling quality stone might be carried some distance, and occasionally even raw blocks were transported quite far directly to sites. Sometimes their previous activity at sites could change things. As level J in Abric Romani built up, Neanderthals began reducing the amount of stone blocks they brought in because they were recycling artifacts from older occupations. When we zoom out further and look at techno-complexes, it's clear that the decisions Neanderthals were making about moving stone around varied. In assemblages using technological systems like Levallois or Kena, which were focused on producing flakes that could be carried for some time and resharpened, the amount of artifacts made with distant stone is higher. And in discoid assemblages, which in technological terms appear to be much more immediate and even disposable, there's very rarely anything that's been brought in from farther than 30 kilometres or 20 miles or so. Geology, technology, and mobility were all intertwined. Scrutinising the shifting of stone by Neanderthals has other implications beyond their capacity for planning or managing time and resources. Since the distances their artifacts moved were, for many decades, the only direct measure of mobility, they ended up being used as a proxy for range size. Because at any site, almost everything came from within 60 kilometres or 40 miles, prehistorians proposed that Neanderthals mostly moved around in quite small areas, essentially the size of the English county of Shropshire. Range size isn't just about land, but about people. If Neanderthals lived in small areas, maybe just across a couple of valleys, then they'd rarely meet other groups. Moreover, without large territories and extended social relations, it was theorised that Neanderthals wouldn't need material expressions of shared cultural values, which can help maintain networks. The comparison, as so often, was with early Homo sapiens in the Upper Paleolithic. While their lithic assemblages also have largely very local stone sources, artefacts that came from beyond 60 kilometres or 40 miles are more numerous, and the distances are greater. Predictably, this was presented as reflecting larger territories and stronger social networks. But digging into the data, as well as our assumptions about what stone sourcing means, produces different answers. First, for people used to walking everywhere, 60 kilometres or 40 miles is certainly feasible for a return day trip, for sources located 30 kilometres or 20 miles away. That Neanderthals mostly lived within the walkable distance between sunrise and sunset seems very unlikely when ethnographic data is examined. It's actually normal for small numbers of people from hunter-gatherer groups to go off for short trips lasting more than a day. And as we've seen, in Neanderthal sites, the type and state of artefacts from those distances doesn't fit the pattern we'd expect if rock was brought straight from the source. The real proof that Neanderthals cannot have been limited to geographically small ranges comes from the much farther travelled artefacts sourced beyond 60 kilometres or 40 miles, and sometimes well over 100 kilometres or 60 miles. Generally sparse in each assemblage, prehistorians tended to ignore them in large part because working out what they mean is difficult. Yet their rarity doesn't mean they're anomalies, and in fact, they were already there in the early Middle Paleolithic. Fundamentally, they're the best data we have about the true extent of the landscapes Neanderthals moved over. But what do these distances mean in terms of mobility? Today's best ultramarathoners can cover 1,000 kilometres or 620 miles in a week, and even normal athletes can manage up to 200 kilometres or 120 miles in 24 hours. While Neanderthal bones bear witness to extremely physical lives, and they were probably more efficient striders than us, long-distance running was not a forte. Factoring that in, together with shorter legs making them up to 10% slower, and the impact of realistic terrain, a day's trek drops well below 100 kilometres or 60 miles. Add in the varying travel pace for entire groups, including youngsters and those with added burdens, whether hauling stuff or simply from age, and it's obvious that artefacts from beyond 80 to 100 kilometres, 50 to 60 miles, cannot have been directly sourced. Furthermore, truly immense stone transport distances exist. For example, at Mesmiskia, not only are there lithics from multiple points across a region extending out around 100 kilometres or 60 miles, but obsidian was also arriving from 200 to 250 kilometres, 120 to 150 miles, to the southeast, and flint from some 300 kilometres or 190 miles northwest. That's at the extreme end of the spectrum, but transfers over 100 kilometres or 60 miles are known throughout the Neanderthal world. How can we understand what such vast spans of landscape, more than halfway between London and Le Moustier in the Périgord, mean for how Neanderthals moved around? It mustn't be assumed every object in an assemblage was contemporary, but even so, they prove sites were nodes within larger networks taking many days to traverse. And it's unlikely any particular excavated locale will have been at one end of a territory. Therefore, a 300-kilometre or 190-mile movement is probably only part of the landscape familiar to the Neanderthal who carried that artefact. If we also consider that many far-travelled artefacts have clearly been used and resharpened before ending up at a particular site, even starting with a large initial flake, it wouldn't be that long until they were used up. In order to be carried over a number of days from source to the eventual place they were left, this implies two possibilities. Perhaps Neanderthals were hauling spare stone around to replenish their stocks. If so, we should see more telltale waste at medium distances up to about 50 kilometres or 30 miles. There are resharpening flakes from moved on bifaces and tools, but they're often not from so far, and cores, let alone raw blocks being moved over these scales, are extremely rare. The other alternative is that artefacts sourced between 100 and 300 kilometres, 60 and 190 miles, are material manifestations of Neanderthals covering huge stretches of land while barely stopping and using the tools. Such rapid, extensive schlepping doesn't fit a notion of aimless wandering, but makes sense if Neanderthals were travelling in a targeted way to known locations. It's possible that heavily laden entire groups could have moved this far over the space of a week or so. Particular conditions might push such decisions. A major migration motivator for reindeer is to escape the torturing summer mosquito swarms. But across the breadth of environments Neanderthals lived in, we should expect them to have moved around in diverse ways. The extremely minimal occupation traces at Abric del Pastor are proof that on occasion very small numbers of individuals were travelling together, while places like Abric Romani equally prove that home sites existed where food was arriving, having been hunted and sometimes partially prepared elsewhere. Adding all this up, it may well be that artefacts from extremely distant sources were left by just one or two Neanderthals who had travelled hard and fast, at a pace beyond less mobile group members, whether heavily pregnant women, the infirm, or toddlers. Splitting the group up in this way might be worth it to take advantage of seasonal bounty. And there's an intriguing comparison in some North American Paleo-Indian contexts. Very long-distance lithic movements, some exceeding those seen with Neanderthals, are believed to be tools sourced near far-off bison kill sites, brought back, along with precious meat and fat, by hunting parties. That we see something similar for Neanderthals leads to the conclusion that they too had impressive knowledge of resources across an enormous territory, and probably mentally scheduled when and where to be. Social stones. Another possibility exists that would explain some of the lithics from distant stone sources, but it's almost never seriously discussed. Exchange. Giving and receiving objects or resources like food is a crucial way humans of all stripes maintain relationships. For hunter-gatherers living in small populations who don't meet often, it's especially important. Despite indications, as we'll see later, that some Neanderthals were genetically isolated, this isn't always the case. As hominins, highly attuned to everything in their familiar home regions, the presence of other groups would surely have been noticed and encounters taken place. Prehistorians have long framed these as probably antagonistic, but there's no strong reason to believe that. Neanderthals lived in social contexts where food was cooperatively obtained and shared, so the idea of giving and receiving things with close relations who may have moved into other groups or even strangers may not have been alien. All these questions about social networks and mobility come down to how Neanderthal societies were structured. Total population estimates tend to be in tens of thousands or even less. At any point in time, there may have been fewer Neanderthals walking about than commuters passing each day through Clapham Junction, London's busiest train station. Can we say anything about how groups were organised beyond the fact they sometimes seem to have separated into smaller units? Studies on recent hunter-gatherers find an average of about 25 people who largely live and travel with each other. Known as a band, they're fluid entities. Some may stick together, others routinely split up for particular activities. This might mean hunting parties or even just a couple of adults and associated children heading off to live independently in summer. Temporary rearrangements can happen for many reasons, including imminent births or simply a desire to visit kin. Actually seeing this kind of thing in the archaeological record for Neanderthals is challenging, but not impossible. Somewhere between 4 to 10 humans can fit around a hearth, which are usually spaced between 1.5 and 2 metres, or 1.6 and 2.2 yards apart. So synchronous activity areas, multiple fires, and especially rubbish dumps in places like Abercromarny or La Folie point to between 10 and 20 individuals. In other words, the size of a typical band. One meticulously excavated site may be the closest we'll ever get to a group photo. Le Rozel, on today's northwest French coast, contains many sandy layers backed up against a cliff and dunes. Astonishingly, a series of levels from around 80,000 years ago preserve hundreds of footprints. In the richest phase, careful size comparisons show that at least 4 and probably over 10 individuals were here. Most fascinating, they're largely adolescents and children as young as 2 years old. With so few adults, it's hard to imagine this was a full group. And instead, it looks like a pack of youngsters foraging at the beach. In hunter-gatherer societies, beyond bands, there are larger networks that connect communities. Often related by blood, but also other kinds of kinship, they're termed clans. Bands maintain ties with others within their clan, both through random meetings and via gatherings that, though not necessarily formal, take place around predictable circumstances. Is it possible Neanderthal groups were linked to each other across watersheds or beyond mountains by something like a clan structure? So far, no sites have been found where large numbers of contemporary hearths and activity areas would indicate a mass gathering. But that's not to say situations didn't exist that attracted a lot of Neanderthals to the same place at the same time. Some seasonal events temporarily bring together even solitary predators. Think of grizzly bears lining rivers for the Pacific salmon run. A number of sites point to Neanderthals being present for probably seasonal hunting, with slaughter in profusion. For example, at Meuron, it's bison, while at Salzgitter-Lebenstedt, it's reindeer. With prey gluts, competition was reduced, meaning individuals were freer to socialise and perhaps move groups. Equally, encounters with unfamiliar groups would have been less stressful. If exchanges of lithics ever happened for social reasons, this would be a likely setting. With the objects in question, perhaps made of unfamiliar stone, then carried onwards from the slaughtering grounds, along with fat, meat, and marrow. That's all speculation, of course, but it remains true that despite being very sparsely scattered across the land, not all Neanderthals were genetically inbred, and so the question is how they maintained DNA diversity. The patterns of lithic movements prove that tough terrain wasn't an obstacle. At least some individuals or whole groups crossed even mighty rivers like the Rhône and high mountain passes in the Massif Central and Pyrenees. Perhaps some populations that became genetically isolated, like those in Iberia and the Altai, lived in rich environments without large migratory game herds as an incentive to travel outside their normal range. Fundamentally, there's no solid reason to assume all Neanderthals disliked strangers, especially since, as we'll see in chapter 14, they were open to intimate relations with other sorts of hominins. If they did happen, rendezvous with strangers on the steppe may have been more like unexpected holiday romances than annual summer camps. But what's interesting too is that over time, very long-distance transfers become more common. Something was changing in the way Neanderthals lived in the landscape after 150,000 years ago, but working out what caused it is one of the hardest remaining problems. Rock to bone. Stone movements had long been the only measure of Neanderthal mobility. But 21st century analytical techniques opened up another route. A growing range of biogeochemical methods can track the movements of individual Neanderthals using stable isotopes. Mobility isotopes provide information on where an individual had previously lived, although, as with dietary analysis, it only records parts of the life history. Strontium isotopes vary according to bedrock and get into teeth through food and drinking water. The data looks more like weather pressure maps with bands across different regions than pinprick locations. But by comparing the values in teeth to the geology where they were found, it's possible to see movement from different geological areas, sometimes with dramatic results, such as the Bronze Age person buried near Stonehenge who had grown up in the Alps. The few Neanderthal studies so far haven't thrown up anything like that, but they have demonstrated that entire lives weren't spent in single valleys. The first sample was an adult from Lakonis, Greece, who lived for part of their childhood somewhere up to 20 kilometres or 12 miles away. A more distant measure came from an Eemian tooth at the site of Moulin-Guercy, France, pointing to a move from geology at least 50 kilometres or 30 miles to the south, with matching lithics too. But there are complications, and these measures may be underestimates. Because tooth enamel can take a year or more to form, and everything we know from archaeology says that Neanderthals weren't staying in one place that long, there's potentially some isotopic blurring when crossing between different geological areas. Additionally, if Neanderthals were eating a lot of animals with isotopic signatures from distant regions, this might also confuse things. To balance out some of these issues, it's possible to combine isotopic data with lithics. Between about 250 and 200,000 years ago, Neanderthals living along the Rhone River returned again and again to the Peyre rock shelter. But over time, its place within their wider movements through the landscape shifted. Earlier on, it seems they stayed for longer, hunting prey mostly in the valleys at different times of year. The lithics were largely arriving from within about 30 kilometres or 20 miles up on the plateau and hills. Using oxygen and lead isotopes at the micro scale, seasonal early childhood movements of a Neanderthal who eventually died at Peyre, though was perhaps born elsewhere, can be tracked. After entering the world in spring, the tooth shows exposure to lead from around 2.5 months old. It's possible that this points to the baby's group having moved for the summer to a region where the natural geology had higher amounts of this element. A subsequent but strong lead peak implies they moved again at least once more in the winter before the baby's first birthday. Nearly a year later, just as the baby hit toddlerhood, another lead phase lasting a bit over a fortnight is followed by medium to high levels for 7 months. If all these lead fluctuations really do mark movement, then we might be looking at a roughly annual range covering at least two locales. At first, the baby must have been carried, and then perhaps toddled after its parents along already familiar paths. Over time, the Peyre rock shelter filled up with sediments, and Neanderthals stayed less, mostly in autumn. The lithic assemblages become sparser, more obviously resharpened, and detailed analysis based on over 200 sources show that far-travelled artefacts become both more numerous and diverse. Some of the new sources are more remote, up to 60 kilometres or 40 miles away, and reveal that Neanderthals were now more often bringing rock from the river valley gravels, including crossing the Rhone River. However, the diet isotopes suggest that the landscape focus of hunting was reversed, with more prey species pointing to hills and plateau like red deer and tar, although a preserved fish scale shows some food came from the valleys. Strontium isotopes from some Neanderthal teeth also hint at periods spent up on the plateau, but another oxygen and lead study on a child's tooth gives more detail. Forming when its owner was around 3 years old, once more there are distinct lead peaks, but they don't start until around the age of five. What's more, the season had changed. The first peak comes during early spring, and there's another nearly 18 months later, probably in autumn. The group this youngster lived with seemed to have been moving on a different schedule, possibly shifting more often. Moreover, the most distant stone objects aren't heavily resharpened tools but flakes, hinting that the length of movements may well have altered too. Another kind of isotope, sulfur, allows dietary comparisons between carnivores and prey and may point to very long distance movements by some Neanderthals. And most interesting, analysis of fossils from two Belgian sites dating to broadly 40,000 years ago, Spee and Goye, nevertheless gave quite different results. The Spee Neanderthals were mostly eating species from nearby, primarily mammoth. But at Goye, the sulphur showed Neanderthals closely matching samples from a cave lion and a wolf, or possibly fox. Unlike most other predators there that were hunting local species like horse, woolly rhino, and bison, this particular lion and wolf were eating something else. Cave bear is one possibility for the lion, since this was sometimes their favoured prey. But the wolf doesn't match that either, and along with the Neanderthal, looks as if it might have been eating reindeer. Two scenarios might explain this. The reindeer found at Goye may have lived farther away, as much as 100 kilometres or 60 miles, but were hunted locally during seasonal migrations. Or, alternatively, it was the predators, including Neanderthals, who were travelling and spending enough time far away for their sulphur signal to shift before arriving at Goye. While distances around 100 kilometres or 60 miles would nicely link to remote lithic transfers, unfortunately, because this site was an old excavation, the data for artefact sourcing isn't available. Where we live. Even if the isotopes haven't yet given abundant evidence for Neanderthals travelling over hundreds of kilometres, when lithics are also considered, it's inescapable something moved over very considerable distances and in quite varied ways. For the stone sourcing, there are only two possibilities. Neanderthals themselves were carrying artefacts, or objects were being exchanged between groups from different regions. Either scenario would raise many questions about social organisation and imply some kind of territorial concept must be part of the answer. Among recent hunter-gatherers, the size of regularly traversed land varies drastically, from 250 to over 20,000 kilometres square, or 100 to 7,700 miles square. That's the difference between a very large city versus a small country. Huge ecological productivity in the tropics means people can get what they need from smaller areas of land. But the ranges for Neanderthals in higher latitudes were more likely towards the upper end. Is it possible to define a particular ancient territory? A step beyond tracing the distances individual artefacts moved is to examine patterns across multiple assemblages. Recent syntheses across more than 20 sites in southwest France found a decidedly skewed pattern in lithic transport. High-quality flint was being carried sometimes up to 100 kilometres or 60 miles, largely eastwards along the Lot and Dordogne valleys. But far less was being moved north or south, and equally, stone from the north is only transferred a few tens of kilometres southwards, with virtually no overlap between the two regions. The strong impression is of some kind of barrier over which stone wasn't being shifted. But the question is why? There's no obvious geographical boundary which leaves something to do with either logistics, a point at which lithics tended to be replaced with local stone rather than transported onwards, or a social factor. What's striking is that compared to some of the known long-distance movements from Europe and elsewhere, the lithics that were moving up to but not beyond this zone in either direction hadn't come especially far, which might indicate it was about territory rather than economics. To 21st century Western minds, territory evokes borders, commerce, and ownership. But for recent hunter-gatherer societies, rather different concepts exist. Conflict isn't unknown, and members of a band's extended social network, the clan, may be more welcome than true strangers. But often access to land can be fluid. Territorial boundaries may exist without being explicitly defended. Although particular places may be restricted, and sometimes bands may freely move over land at least double the size of their claimed territory. On top of this, it's quite possible that some of the complex mobility patterns seen in Neanderthals might derive from individuals, not groups. Their closest fellow predators in social terms are wolves, where up to a fifth of individuals at some point are wanderers between packs. Adolescents can embark on vast treks over hundreds of kilometres before settling down. One remarkable tracked female, known as Naya, loped all the way from East Germany to Belgium, sometimes covering 30 to 70 kilometres or 20 to 40 miles a night. Perhaps some of the longest stone movements were Neanderthal Nayas, searching across mountain ranges and rivers for a welcome at a new hearth. How places and things were connected in the Neanderthal world is perhaps the most testing of puzzles about them. It requires aligning all the jigsaw pieces of technology, subsistence, and mobility, as well as climate. Dramatic changes after 150,000 years ago, from full interglacial to deep glacial and everything in between, were very likely part of the reason for Neanderthals' growing flexibility, as well as specialisation. Everyday experiences began to look quite different depending on where and when they lived. One of the ways to explore this is through the techno-complexes. Some unarguably were better suited to different sorts of mobility, and if the need to move was driven largely by finding animals, which itself varied according to climate and environment, then looking for extremes may help us see unique Neanderthal lifestyles. The sun-drenched Eemian is an obvious place to start. It was the warmest and lushest world Neanderthals experienced, and though sites are rare, they're distinctive. Good evidence for whether forest hunting was different comes from two spear sites, Laringen and Neumark Nord. At the former, the spear is thicker than those at Schöningen and looks more like it was intended for thrusting. But it's also still quite long. Perhaps in this case the prey species made a difference. Elephant hunters may have wanted a healthy distance between the bloodied, raging beast and their own bodies. At Neumark Nord, where two big stags were killed, the spears themselves are missing, but their shadows remain in the holes they punched through bone. Both deer seem to have been taken out by close-range, low thrusts, which is definitely far better suited to dense woodland hunting than throwing javelins, like those at Schöningen. What also makes Neumark Nord stand out compared to the vast majority of Neanderthal kill sites in any time and space, is that after scoring two top condition stags fat from autumn's plenty, they barely butchered them. Even the most processed individual was simply filleted, but not jointed. Moreover, there's no marrow smashing. Why leave rich calories behind? The implication is that they weren't struggling for food. If these forest Neanderthals had become adept at ambush tactics between trunks and brush, then abandoning carcasses might not have been a big loss in energetic terms. More intriguingly, treating carcasses this way indicates they weren't the starting point for staged butchery processing through the landscape. That would make sense if there were fewer hungry bellies waiting elsewhere. It's quite possible that adapting to the rapid growth of the Eemian forests may have forced Neanderthal society to splinter into much smaller units, able to cope with animals that no longer gathered in big herds. Smaller groups living in leaf-dappled light may not have needed to move so often, and the lithics back this up. They're generally not technologically suited to being carried and resharpened for long periods, and tend to be made with very local rocks. Reindeer people. At the other end of the climate and environment spectrum, the Neanderthals of the Kina techno-complex experienced life very differently. Of all the lithic traditions, Kina is especially distinctive in being notably restricted in time and space. While some early Middle Paleolithic assemblages have similar tools, the full Kina package doesn't really appear until about 80,000 years ago, during the MIS-4 glacial. Though it continues into MIS-3 after things warmed up, it's largely gone by 50,000 years ago, and primarily found in southern France. The universal feature of all Kina sites here, whatever the climate, is huge amounts of reindeer. The MIS-4 glacial caused a decimation in almost all prey species, apparently reflected in hyenas basically abandoning southwest France. Such a drastic situation must also have impacted Neanderthals, and in this bitterly cold tundra world, reindeer may have been the only decent-sized game available. Was this extreme situation, some 40,000 years after the golden days of the Eemian, the setting for Neanderthals to adapt by developing the Kina and becoming truly specialised hunters? Most striking is that brief, less ice-blasted phases during MIS-4 were enough in some areas for forest-adapted red and even roe deer to reappear, if only temporarily. But they're never found with Kina assemblages, only Levallois. This suggests that the Kina techno-complex really was specialised, and represented a connection to open tundra southwest France and the large reindeer herds they contained. Reindeer have always been of particular interest for discussions about how Neanderthals hunted and moved around the landscape because of their great migrations. Today, the distances involved vary, and trying to track exactly how far Pleistocene reindeer travelled is the subject of ongoing research. But what's certain is that they did move and gather seasonally. This would have happened during autumn breeding and spring birthing. Reindeer fawns from caves in the British Midlands show that there was a calving ground here, but where the animals were coming from isn't known. In southwest France, the site of Jonzac has provided huge amounts of information about how Kina-making Neanderthals were hunting reindeer. Mobility isotope analysis for the animals suggests that youngsters killed there in autumn and winter had already done a year's migration between geologically different regions. In this case, rather than following herds, Neanderthals seem to have been waiting where their new reindeer would gather, or perhaps intercepting them along a known route between seasonal aggregations. Jonzac's nearly 1 metre or 3 foot thick layer 22 is so stuffed with reindeer, it's known as the bone bed. From an area just 3 metres square or 3.5 yards square in extent and 30 centimetres or 12 inches thick, over 5,000 bones were excavated. They represent at least 18 individual animals, and whole carcasses were being butchered here. If this cliff base wasn't the kill site itself, it must have been very close by. Even if not a mass kill, what points most strongly to this having been selective hunting from among large numbers of animals is the fact that some prime parts, including entire limbs, were left unbutchered. These Neanderthals were not starving. Not quite 80 kilometres or 50 miles northeast from Jonzac is another Kina site, Les Pradelles. Chapter 7 described the huge number of bone retouches there, mostly made from reindeer bone. They were part of a cycle. Retouchers formed and resharpened the Kina scrapers, which then processed yet more reindeer bodies. What's especially interesting about the best studied layer, 4A, is that while 98% of all animal remains are reindeer, this probably wasn't the kill site. It's quite clear that Neanderthals had slaughtered and prepped carcasses elsewhere before selecting mostly limbs and some heads for further butchery at Les Pradelles. Therefore, this was a hunting camp, but it must have been located close to a known locale where herds gathered, or a migration route. The archaeology overall points to Neanderthals staying only for short periods of intensive activity. But this happened over and over through some 2 metres or 6 feet of deposits, representing multiple generations and probably hundreds of reindeer. The Pêche de l'Azay 4 rock shelter represents a different kind of Kina site, where hunting seems to have been during spring. The bone breakage is even more intensive, potentially because there's less body fat after winter, and so getting marrow was even more important. Reindeer often take different routes during their autumn and spring migrations, and while predictable year to year during stable climate conditions, that may have changed from 60,000 years ago with the beginning of MIS3. The timing of herd movements, routes and locations of gatherings must have been disrupted, pushing Neanderthals to greater flexibility and rapid travelling once the animals were sighted, or perhaps heard. The first sign may have been the collective noise of clicking hooves moving through tundra herbs, velvety muzzles chewing and bleat grunts well before curving antlers appeared over the horizon. There are small amounts of other species in Kina sites of this age, including bison, horse and woolly rhino at Jonzac. They may have been hunted while groups waited for reindeer to arrive, or even food supplies brought in from elsewhere. They certainly weren't whole carcasses and often look less heavily processed than the reindeer. Yet in some cases they have more damage from scavengers. Perhaps Neanderthals sometimes used hunting camps during other, leaner times of year. Big surpluses from reindeer probably meant Neanderthals adapted in other ways beyond hunting tactics. A portion of the marrow, fat, filleted meat and other parts was probably eaten immediately. But it looks as if most was being shifted onwards to other places, along with freshly made lithics that had been napped to butcher them. At Les Pradelles, for example, there are 5 times more bone retouchers than the tools they were used to work, and both new Kina flakes and scrapers are missing. It's also possible that some of the marrow, meat, fat, and some lithics were moving over a short distance outside the site, to areas containing hearths but which weren't excavated. As mentioned in Chapter 9, many Kina sites, including Jonzac, Les Pradelles, Pêche de l'Azay 4 and Roc de Marsal, lack hearths and abundant charcoal. But that doesn't mean fire wasn't being used, as shown by burned flints. If hunting camps were dealing with multiple reindeer carcasses at once, it's quite likely a number of individuals were present, perhaps the whole group. Neanderthals would have needed to spread out their activity areas, just like at home sites like Abercromarnie. Certainly, an awful lot of bone smashing was going on. Not only is everything highly fragmented, but often the fatty bone ends are missing. Either they were being simply crushed, perhaps with marrow, into a kind of bone pate, or there was more complicated processing. Some kind of heating and rendering into grease would make more sense if all this abundant food was going to be taken onwards, in addition to means for preserving meat and fat. These would likely be happening away from the main butchery area and waste dumps. Remarkable excavation of a reindeer hunting site at Anaktuvuk Pass, used by Inupiat people in Alaska, gives a hint of what this kind of camp could have looked like. The pass itself has been used for at least 3,500 years, and one area dating back 500 years contains remains from late summer, early autumn hunts. Across some 90 metres square or 107 yards square, clear spatial organisation is visible. Without a cave or rock shelter, people stayed in tents, but it was warm enough not to need sleeping hearths. There were fires, however, all within the main carcass processing and grease rendering zones, plus separate dumps for animal and lithic waste. While this isn't to say we should expect a mirror image in Neanderthal sites, it's quite possible that the keener cave or rock shelter inner zones are actually the messy dump zones, and hearths were farther outside. Whichever time of year, the kind of hunting we see keener Neanderthals doing implies impressive logistical planning. Beyond timing, having to work at scale to catch and butcher many reindeer may imply that it wasn't just space being separated by activity, but also the group itself. Hunter-gatherers of all kinds have very different habits in terms of who goes on hunts, but tackling herds would always require more hands than tracking and killing single beasts. There are hints at some keener sites of systematic butchery techniques, which probably means those doing the initial cutting and jointing, as well as trickier things like removing tendons, weren't inexperienced. But marrow smashing was potentially something even youngsters could get stuck into. During the MIS-4 glacial, when there were hardly any other animals about, large herds would have attracted a lot of attention. Whoever came from individual groups to kill and take apart the reindeer would have faced other hungry carnivores, as shown by cut-marked cave lion and fox bones at Jonzac. Moreover, predictable seasonal hunts in roughly the same place every year may well have been opportunities for another resource vital to Neanderthals, socialising. Under the skin. There's one other intriguing aspect to what keener Neanderthals were doing. It clearly replaces a Levallois-based way of life at the end of MIS-5 or very early MIS-4, but why? Levallois is no less suited to butchery, and it's definitely portable. But keener has two unique features. First, it's more economical in terms of both time and stone, since the cores don't need as much management. And second, keener flakes may often be smaller, but they're thicker and stronger. And their shape, with one fat natural edge, means they can take far more resharpening and produce more second generations. If Neanderthals were having to cope with infrequent but intensive bouts of butchery, there would certainly be a need for resharpening. But something else can explain the distinctiveness of keener tools and even the particular technique of resharpening. Long, curved, steep edges are perfect for hide working. So far, we've mostly mentioned this technology in relation to toothwear seen in many Neanderthals. But there's plenty of other evidence that they were accomplished hide workers. As a starting point, in many sites, the placement of cut marks and even the types of bones suggest animal skins and furs were being carried around. More direct proof, however, are usewear traces on lithic artefacts. The majority of tools with polish from scraping and rubbing skins would have been used either in combination with holding in the mouth or against a leg, or a hard surface like a log to push against. It's even possible sometimes to distinguish lithics that had been used to scrape fresh, moist skins from those that worked dried hide, which marks a second phase of processing. It's useful to understand quite how complex hide working actually is, both in terms of stages and time. Preparing one deerskin takes about a day if the weather's good. The first job is to get off all the gore, which needs to be done while skins are still fresh, since drying causes fats to congeal and stick. This implies that Neanderthals would need to do this very soon after killing, perhaps at nearby hunting camps. After cleaning and drying, skins can potentially be stored for months. Since Neanderthals were habitually undertaking phased butchery and napping in different places, this was even more likely with hide working, since it required a lot of time. And in fact, rolled up hides exposed to a winter's smoke can even be in better condition. After this comes softening for pliability and preserving. Typically, it begins with soaking, sometimes with added wood ash, since the alkaline properties help get grease out. Neanderthals might have used rivers, lakes, or melted snow and ice as a soaking container. But large animal stomachs, or even pits, are another possibility. Across the world, many traditional methods exist for hide improving, but fats of some sort are always involved. Brains and marrow are especially good, as is bear fat, all of which penetrate deeply and help with waterproofing. Whatever the fatty mixture chosen, after soaking it must be worked into the skin, which is either stretched or in some other way continuously manipulated. This is where using mouths as a means of holding on comes in, while smoking the skin during this phase can help keep it soft and enable it to re-soften later when being used after getting wet. But smoking is also exceptional for preserving hides, and among Northern Hemisphere hunter-gatherers, falling apart rotten wood is almost universally used. Can Neanderthals truly have used a process as complicated as this? Hide working was already happening well before 300,000 years ago, as suggested by collagen and hair residues from below the spear horizon at Schöningen, and polish on a bone tool there can only have got that way from hours of use. For Kinosites, Usware at Schonzach found that a large number of studied artefacts had distinctive polish from working fresh skins, showing that Neanderthals were getting the essential cleaning stage done during initial carcass processing. One tool, however, had distinctive traces showing it had been used on dried hide. Perhaps it was used to prepare a hide made elsewhere, or was simply brought into Schonzach with previously acquired wear. It was certainly retouched again afterwards. Beyond specific activities at Schonzach, though, this implies that reindeer hides at hunting camps were, like the meat, fat, and marrow, part of a web of materials at different stages of manufacture that Neanderthals were moving around. Why did Neanderthals need substantial amounts of hides? One possibility, hardly ever discussed, is that boiling hide together with bones, tendons, and hooves is a well-known method for making glue. The released collagen makes an adhesive that's been exploited since medieval times as not only strong but good for delicate work, since it's self-sticking, shrinks as it dries, and can be remoulded by heating like birch tar. But scraps will do for this, and you don't need to process animal skins to the extent that Neanderthals did. The obvious answer is, of course, clothing. Many reconstructions show Neanderthals draped in the barest tattered skins, and it's also been claimed that the relative scarcity of small furred predators means they only wore loose capes. But thermal modelling shows that unless they were super fat and thickly furred like bears, fitted clothing of some sort was vital. Well-insulated clothing is possible even without a natty wolverine trim, and Neanderthals could take their pick from reindeer, bison, bear, or others. Moreover, eyed needles aren't necessary for tailoring clothing, as hides can be pierced with stone, bone, or even wooden awls that push thread through instead of pulling. What about feet? There's no evidence of hard-soled shoes, but softer foot coverings wouldn't leave a trace. Production is relatively simple too. A deer's hind leg provides a ready-made tube to slide onto the foot. If done while wet, it will shrink wrap as it dries. What makes the production of clothing especially likely beyond Neanderthals' physiology is the multiple lines of evidence for massive processing to soften and stretch hides, notably seen in their clamping and probably also chewing tooth wear. It matches exactly that seen in hunter-gatherers who do this with skins and also sinews, and what's more is almost identical to early Homo sapiens samples. It's far less difficult to imagine those populations wearing reindeer parkas, but Neanderthals from open habitats, which are likely to have been colder, actually have even more heavy wear. So, they wore clothes, and probably keener Neanderthals in particular. But what kind of quantities of hides are we talking? Based on a fairly simple outfit with an upper body garment and leggings or skirt, each adult would need at least 5 large hides. To make this from scratch would take somewhere between 20 and 80 solid hours of hide processing, depending on species and the particularities of the process. This outfit would need replacing every few years, and then there's children's garments and coverings for infants. As well as the worn teeth, we can recall how Neanderthals' arms were thickened from huge pulling forces, much of it potentially from a lifetime where hide working was a never-ending task. If that's not convincing, then in addition to the use wear on lithics from many sites is a recently discovered class of shaped bone tools. Made from rib ends, Neanderthals carved the bone to narrow it and form a standardised, symmetrical round tip. So far, there are only 5 known examples, but they come from 2 sites. 1 from Pêche de l'Azay and 4 from Abri-Péronie, just 35 kilometres or 22 miles away, where they're in different layers, one with bifaces and another discoid. They're all broken, but a nearly identical, complete object found in 1907 at La Quina may show their original form. It's strongly curved and the opposite end was left unaltered. These tools are virtual clones of things called lissoirs, or smoothers, which are not only found in later Homo sapiens cultures, but still used today to soften and burnish animal skins. And even the damage on the Neanderthal examples fits this. All are tips snapped off due to intense pressure during use. Given how discriminating Neanderthals were about the animals and body parts their retouches came from, it's perhaps not surprising that they weren't just selecting ribs for lissoirs, but also by species. Collagen analysis found that all the surviving objects are either bison or aurochs, and strikingly, 3 are from a layer at Abri-Péronie that's 90% reindeer. Those sites date to around 50 to 40,000 years and show that only a few thousand years after the Kena technocomplex disappears, Neanderthals had extremely sophisticated processing techniques. Whether or not lissoirs were also used by the Kena reindeer hunters isn't certain, but perhaps, as well as clothing, they had other motivations for intensive hide working. If we recall the impression that many Kena sites, even places one stage beyond hunting camps, don't look particularly like homes with hearths, then perhaps these Neanderthals were using tents or shelters. We know from La Folie that open-air constructions of some sort were used later. But truly mobile shelters formed from hides would have allowed Kena-making Neanderthals to move flexibly across the tundra and stay warm while ranging over long distances. Even if they obviously returned time and again to particular caves or cliffs for the hunting and initial butchery, the lack of hearths, despite there being some burned materials, suggests we're missing these parts of sites. Big teepees of the sort crafted by indigenous cultures in North America, like the Cayuse, Dakota, Blackfeet, Pawnee, Crow and Plains Cree can use 30 to 50 deer skins, but transporting all that was typically aided by horses. It's unlikely that structures on that scale would have been dragged around by Neanderthals, but perhaps smaller tents were used, and there's also the evidence for hide mats at Abercromarnie. What's interesting about a way of life requiring many skins, whether for clothing or shelters, is that it sometimes results in so-called wasteful hunting, where animals are targeted not for meat, but skins. Summer reindeer are pretty lean and warm weather makes meat spoil fast, but their skins are in good condition, whereas by the autumn they're often becoming less so, not helped by holes parasites leave in the hide. Apart from hides and choice cuts like tongues, other parts might be left behind. And there are occasional hints of this in some Neanderthal reindeer sites, keener or not. At Schonzach, there are a few still articulated limb joints. Something similar is known from Abri de Maras in southeast France, and many carcasses at Salzgitter Lebenstedt also look quite lightly butchered. Hides can also produce things just as vital to hunter-gatherer life, but often overlooked in their ubiquity today – bags. The average Neanderthal probably had a lot to carry – food, fresh skins, furs, perhaps bedding, not to mention stone. Natural bags might be made from animal stomachs or bladders, but hides are especially useful because they're tough and big. Rolled around objects and bound with sinew or tendon, they could have been slung over shoulders to ease heavy loads. It's perfectly feasible to use a freshly tugged off skin like this. Sites with a lot of foot bones might reflect the limb extremities being left on, like handles on old-fashioned travel bags. Containers are also connected to food storage, perhaps especially important in the Kena. As noted in Chapter 8, there's no direct evidence Neanderthals stored food, but in a glacial setting where most meat was sourced during big seasonal hunts, it may have been necessary. By now, it should be clear Neanderthals partitioned all kinds of activities and materials across the landscape. So taking this a step further by preserving parts for later isn't such a stretch. Depending on how it was stored, the glut could provide nutrition for weeks or even months and would have been especially important if winter was coming. Drying meat might have been difficult in soggy weather, but during glacial periods, summer and autumn were probably drier. If keener Neanderthals at hunting camps were staying long enough to get the first stage of hide processing done, there may have been enough time to also begin drying meat, rendering grease, or even using hide smoking fires for preserving edible animal parts. Such multitasking would certainly fit the efficiency we see in so many other aspects of Neanderthal behaviour. What happened to the Kena Neanderthals? If this techno-complex emerged as an adaptation, making the most of glacial tundra and its reindeer, how did they cope when things warmed up? As we saw earlier, some later sites include a few horses, aurochs, or bison, and at a handful of locales those species actually dominate. This might reflect some Neanderthals trying to adapt to steppe life. But on the other hand, in the Western Pyrenees, there's still a link between cold climate, reindeer, and Kena as late as 45,000 years ago. After this, however, the package seems to finally disappear. Yet when talking about the Kena, we encounter the tension in archaeologists' desire to classify lithic techno-complexes versus the variety in what Neanderthals needed and wanted to do. A few sites here and there have lithics that look in all respects to be Kena technology, complete with massive amounts of retouches. But they're living rather different lives. One case is the Italian cave of De Nadale, up in the Alpine foothills. It contains an MIS4 assemblage closely resembling the contemporary Kena in southwest France, except here Neanderthals were mostly hunting giant deer and red deer. These species have totally different ecology and behaviour to reindeer. and it may be that Kena-making groups moved into this region and adapted, or it was an independent innovation. Living landscapes. How did Neanderthals think about their world? Beyond daily tasks, waking well-rested or groggy, helping children eat, finding flakes within stone, following animals, what did travelling, pausing for an afternoon, or spending many days somewhere mean to them? Although it's already featured in this and other chapters, the word home is tricky, automatically bringing to mind 21st century Western concepts of a fixed place. But for people living by moving, home will be many locales. The heart of existence moves too. Intimacy with kin is one constant that would have made a Neanderthal feel at home, but their deep familiarity with the wider landscape was probably another kind of relationship. Neanderthals' thoughts and memories must have included individual, well-known places. The bluff rising beyond the hill, the stand of pines by the ford, the dark opening in the cliff. Oft repeated or extraordinary experiences are especially powerful in binding memories, and are more likely to be recalled when particular locales were revisited. Landscapes, for Neanderthals therefore, weren't abstract spaces, but a continuous flow of lived encounters, both new and remembered. This is a kind of history, which would have been soaked up from childhood through attention and probably direct communication. But places are something more, their meaning manifesting through slow accretion over time of custom and memory. And then there are the archaeological deposits themselves, accumulating through centuries and millennia. Histories in mental and material form probably influenced how Neanderthals chose to use particular places, stimulating even more distilled forms of activity and living. In this way, locales like Schonzach might emerge conceptually as something like Reindeer Hunt Cliff, where truly deep deposits were visible, obviously formed over more than a lifetime, something else might have been sparked. These cultural condensates communicating time itself may have had the power to stretch Neanderthal imaginations beyond the now. We know they recognised and interacted with older objects in rock shelters and caves, but did the sight of deep bone beds or clearly ancient hearths spark a sense of those gone before? We can see in some places that decades or centuries old objects stuck up from the ground, physically crossing time, and must have stimulated an impression of permanence. Moreover, some recycled lithics in caves don't look as if they came from surface scatters. If so, Neanderthals may have been the first archaeologists, unearthing eroded ancient remains of their forebears, turning them around in the light and making them part of the living world once more. Fingers digging down into soft earth, feeling out sharp edges, is a reminder that Neanderthals' experiences of place and land went beyond the visual. They knew rock by its texture as much as its colour, listened to the song of water not just for flow but temperature, and picked out tree species by the changing sound of wind soughing through leaves. For Neanderthals, as with many indigenous cultures, the land itself may have been conceptualised not as some kind of stage upon which to tread, but as someone with whom a relationship or communication was possible. One must always walk in company. It may be speculation to muse on how the land was perceived, but as they strode, crept, and ran, Neanderthals inscribed themselves upon it. Hundreds of millennia before anyone wrote the first word, their footprints were a kind of signature. We heard earlier about those at Le Rosel, which in total has over 250 prints through several layers. Some are short, step-by-step trails, but mostly they're isolated prints. The smallest feet, those of a toddler, left the lightest trace, and there's even a perfect handprint. Fingers spread wide, pressed into the sand, as if raised in greeting through 80,000 years. The oldest known Neanderthal prints were left more than 250,000 years before those at Le Rozel. On the slopes of the extinct Roccamonfina volcano, southern Italy, they were believed to be the devil's tracks after being revealed by 18th century landslides. In fact, they were left around 350,000 years ago by three early Neanderthals whose feet sank into cooled and rain-softened pyroclastic ash and mudflows. More than 50 prints show how all moved differently. One zigzagged down, another took a cautious curving path, slipping and sometimes dropping down a hand for balance, while the third ploughed in a straight line. All three walkers were under 1.35 metres or 4.4 foot tall, exactly the calculated height of Le Moustier 1, making them young teenagers. It's quite possible that this gang witnessed the eruption that had produced the mixed ash, pumice and rough rock under their feet, and a later ashfall that covered their tracks. Where were they going? Tracing the three trails upslope, all led from a flat ledge speckled for about 50 metres or 55 yards by yet more hominin footprints, as well as those of animals, a Neanderthal routeway. Underground footprints also exist. Around the same time as the Le Rozel children were playing on the Atlantic shores, high in the western Carpathians of Romania, an older teenage Neanderthal was exploring Viatop Cave. They gently stepped through strange moon milk that later hardened into flowstone. Somewhat extraordinarily, this is the only trace Neanderthals were ever in the cave. But elsewhere, other youngsters left traces in living sites. Theopetra Cave in Greece contains a handful of diminutive footprints older than 128,000 years ago, one of which was probably aged just 2 to 4 years old, while there are hints another wore thin foot coverings. That so many of those leaving footprints were youngsters is striking. In many hunter-gatherer societies, children receive little formal teaching from adults, but learn instead by hanging out with their peers. Wandering, exploring, testing and playing grown-up would have happened in living sites, as well as through the surrounding land. It must have opened up exciting adventures as well as risks, and suggests that Neanderthals' experience of the land changed through their lives. Ancient tracks bewitch us today, but traces of living creatures would have interested Neanderthals too. To survive on the bounty of the earth means constant attention to the land, and muddy trails worn into the ground by the passage of many hooves, or even bent grasses left by silent pawpads, would be noticed. But more than this, as hominins lacking the claws, teeth, or great speed of other carnivores, mastering hunting would mean practice, collaboration, and most particularly, knowledge and planning. By combining understandings such as which species drink at dawn with imagination would allow Neanderthals to predict the myriad ways an animal becomes vulnerable. This wisdom may well have been distilled into the skill of tracking. For recent hunter-gatherers, whatever the environment or method of hunting, this is crucial. Tracking is far more than following trails. It's about full attention to the entirety of the world, so that traces even of ants become familiar. Practice trackers can identify not only animal species, but subspecies, sex, age, or even physical condition. It's also possible with larger creatures to recognise familiar individuals. Neanderthals evolved with 30,000 generations of hunting heritage already behind them. Tracking may have developed nearly 1.5 million years ago, as footprints from Illiret, Kenya, show early hominins stalking the muddy margins of a lake where both trails and their makers could be watched and ambushed. Pursuit or endurance hunting is strongly connected to tracking, and involves chasing prey to exhaustion whereupon killing is simple. Wolves and hyenas work this way, and it's especially suited to open environments like steppe. What makes tracking so important in this kind of hunting is that it opens up the ability to predict animals' behaviour. Even novices can just about manage it, as shown by the Liakov family who fled from religious persecution into the Russian taiga in 1936. They survived undisturbed over 240 kilometres or 150 miles from the nearest settlement for 40 years, and a vital supplement to their marginal farming was hunting. But they had no weapons, and the Liakov boys taught themselves to simply chase animals through the forest until they dropped. The Liakovs were rarely successful, sometimes making just one kill a year, whereas Neanderthals had had lifetimes to hone their skills. Even if they preferred ambush to pursuit hunting, tracking must still have been part of this. Tracking has also been suggested as a means by which even more sophisticated hunting evolved, with impacts far beyond subsistence. When trails become hard to follow, a hunter expert in the behaviour of their quarry can predict where its tracks will re-emerge. A frightened, rapidly tiring deer may be more likely to hide than continue running, and knowing this can make the difference between loss or kill. But it's more than knowledge. This skill, known as speculative tracking, entails visualising the animal's state of mind. It requires the cognitive ability to understand that others have outlooks and emotions different to one's own, supposedly possessed by just a handful of species other than humans. Could Neanderthals have done this? Certainly, speculative tracking for hunting would have been useful in tricky environments like forests where animals could disappear. But it would also have helped in more open landscapes, for example predicting when and where herds might appear. Moreover, if Neanderthals' ability as hunters involved tracking and the ability to imagine themselves into other minds, then surely this also involved considering the thoughts of other hominins. Among expert indigenous trackers of the Kalahari, southern Africa, the traces of close relations are as recognisable as their faces. And physical hints of the presence of strangers, whether footprints, lithic scatters, spreads of charcoal, or old carcasses, would have been pored over and of extreme interest, provoking excitement. To live in such a world was to be surrounded by presences of many kinds. Places and people were connected by flows of stone, meat, and other materials, but were also physically linked by tracks on trails. These routes were like rivers of memory, immersing Neanderthals from the time they were carried upon a warm chest to the slow striding elder, recalling the reindeer winters before trees filled the valley. The past five chapters have been a deep dive into Neanderthal life, from micro scales at individual locales where generations exist in each scrape of the trowel, to networks of travellers and objects extending hundreds of kilometres. Compared to the millions of years before, Neanderthal existence was a major upgrade to hominin life. They lived in more complex ways than anything before, and perhaps the best way to think of what the Middle Paleolithic represents is amplification and enhancement. Whatever the ecosystem, they were top-level hunters and canny foragers. Their lithic technology was more efficient and specialised, and they pioneered new ways of using organic materials. But something else more profound was going on. Neanderthals were also the first to truly begin stretching their lives through time and space in a way no earthly creature had ever experienced. They disintegrated stone and animals' bodies in more complicated, systematic ways, and moved the pieces farther than ever before. And even the shift in retouches from entire bones to shards mirrors this growing intensity. And, As objects and activities became more specialized and separated through space and time, they cast a net of presence, action, and intention across land and in the memory. Theirs were minds that looked out to the horizon and knew it intimately. How the paths changed in spring, when the fords would fill, and perhaps even how many sunrises until the great cliffs came into view around the river bend. One might even claim that the first revolution imbuing land with social meaning belonged to Neanderthals, not Homo sapiens. Moreover, all this was happening with ever more collaborative processes, from hunting to butchery, and in the movement of resources and sharing of food. It's even visible within sites, showing that Neanderthals weren't just supporting their kin, but opening up new ways to relate to each other within their most intimate spaces. As more things than ever were extracted and moved around, how one could do simple things like nap became replete with possibilities. Substances were mixed and things combined. The potential for society itself to diversify expanded. Identities could be formed around more than categories such as age, skills and proficiency across ever more specialist crafts, from hunting to hafting to hideworking, were new ways for Neanderthals to place themselves in the world. Proof they did so is worn into their very bones and teeth as intensifying cycles of embodied expertise. The variety of Neanderthal lifestyles are like dances emerging out of the rhythms of particular environments and manifested by techno-complexes and mobility patterns. But the precise tempo and choreography was always unique, a pas de deux shared with the creatures they lived by and with. And even as movement across the landscape grew in scale through time, concurrently place developed greater social significance. Choices about what happened and where had a finer grain than ever before, and internal space was divided accordingly. Neanderthals were accumulating the first great archives, the detritus of life forming unconscious monuments, permanence despite transience. Like wells of memory in a vast, shifting world. It was in these places that Neanderthals first kindled human history and geography. And burning bright at the centre are the fires. Like suns wielding enormous gravitational forces, everything and everyone spiralled around the hot heart of home. 50,000 years later, Neanderthals' hearths still have weirdly cosmic properties. Amid ancient surfaces densely spangled by myriad artifacts, fireplaces are like archaeological wormholes, bridging the impossible chasms of time separating us from long-vanished dwellers. As researchers encircle hearths, recording and excavating, their presence is like an afterglow of human attention, reanimating empty spaces. Time collapses, and it's almost as if our fingers reaching out might graze the warmth of Neanderthal skin, sitting right there beside us. Those bodies, once incandescently alive, now dry bone behind glass, weren't simply engines that needed refueling, or automata for making endless sharp flakes. Just as our days are suffused by social interactions, the kernel of the Neanderthals' world was in their relationships. Physical proximity had been the medium of hominin intimacy for millions of years, measured in touch, glance, guise. But the Neanderthals added new currency, material substances. Composite technology is a time-travelling mind made manifest. And they were surely among the first humans to tell stories. The things they collected, took apart, carried and brought back together were about more than survival. They also mark an amplification in communication, an inexhaustibly rich channel to express connections and meanings beyond the mundane.